You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes a secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. A world dismissed as conspiracy by those who want to keep its secrets hidden, exposing the dangers, denials, and deceptions. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.
And welcome back, folks, to this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. And this is kind of our inaugural, what an inauguration of our new setup here, our new studio. So glad that you're joining us, whether it's by Global Star or BTR or here on our official YouTube channel. Our special in-studio guest is Mr. Jack Cashel, the crash, the cover-up, and the conspiracy. TWA Flight 800, TWA 800. The name of his book coming out July 5th. Right here. Folks, we can change history together. You know, we always say, well, there's nothing we can do. Yeah, there is. We can, number one, drive his book up to number one in on sales, make people take a look at the true facts of TWA Flight 800, what happened on that date 20 years ago next month, an important anniversary coming up on July 17th of 2016. Of course, July 17th, 1996 is when 230 people lost their lives in that incident. And Mr. Cashel has done just an excellent job in documenting 260 pages and out of that, maybe 20 pages of notes, very detailed notes about that back up his assertions, his claims. A tremendous investigative reporter, certainly. Well worth the read. Very important. And what does that have to do with the things happening today? It's the same playbook. And you know, there is a chapter, Jack, in here you wrote. And the chapter is Benghazi Moment, right?
Yeah, the Benghazi Moment, right?
It's the same playbook, basically, that we're seeing today with a lot of other things, and we've seen over the past, but you expose it very well. And of course, again, our guest, Jack Cashel, Cashel.com.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
And Amazon, for the book coming out on July 5th. But let's push it up to number one all across the venues. That would make me happy. I read this. It really, Father's Day, I read a lot of this. I finished on Father's Day.
I was watching the U.S. Open. And the Cleveland Cavaliers, by the way.
Yes.
Kudos to Cleveland.
Yes.
Yeah.
Finally.
But, I'm always happy too. But no, you did an outstanding job on this. All right. So the first hour, we kind of set the stage on a number of issues. We have the NTSB kind of taking a back, not kind of taking a back seat to the FBI, and of course CIA involvement in this. Where do you want to go now?
Which is a break of a regular protocol and procedure when it comes to airline investigation.
Yeah, Title 49.
Yeah, so we left the last hour talking about Richard Clark, who plays a bizarre role in this whole phenomenon. And Richard Clark is, you know, we mentioned was the anti-terror czar under Clinton. And unlike, you know, because he was allegedly nonpartisan and served under other administrations, and including the Bush administrations, I think both of them. But he was seduced by his access to power under the Clintons, because they took him seriously. And he wrote a book, there he is on the screen, and he wrote a book called Against All Enemies. And this is the way the media work. He testifies before the 9/11 Commission in 2004, and then his book comes out like 3 days later. He's on 60 Minutes. He gets all 60 Minutes on 60 Minutes, right? He's on Meet the Press a week later, an hour of that, and then his book shoots up to number one on the bestseller list, and the media are loving it because the thesis of his book is that George W. Bush did a bad job in the fight against terror and was responsible for September 11th. Well, then Clark is testifying before the 9/11 Commission, and he says something interesting. He says, you know, you can forgive an old security, security guy or whatever, that we haven't talked about aviation terror for the last 5 or 6 years. And, you know, part of my thesis is the reason they couldn't talk about aviation terror was if they raised that issue, they raised the question of TWA Flight 800.
Due to the unanswered questions.
Due to the unanswered questions, exactly. And so Clark, in his book, is the only one of the principals to talk about TWA Flight 800 in depth. And the book, and his narrative is a mixture of braggadocio and just stupid mistakes, careless mistakes. It's like he doesn't even care. Because he knows, even though he spends like 6 or 8 pages on TWA Flight 800, he knows the media will not pay any attention to that because what he's saying is Bush did a terrible job in the war on terror, right? That's the takeaway. And he did a terrible job because he didn't take Richard Clark seriously. But Clark's story is simply, it has to be read. I mean, when I first came across his book, I was astonished. He talks about, for instance, first of all, he's got no aviation experience. I don't know what he's doing involved in this. And he goes to the hangar on Long Island at Calverton where they're, you know, doing the investigation. And he talks about, this is roughly about 4 weeks after the crash, based on his own timeline. He talks about walking through the hangar and he's talks to a mechanic, to some random mechanic who's there. And then you have to, those who are listening to the last hour know there was a missile, but That's already off the table. So he walks over to this mechanic, and he says to him, he goes, oh, is this where the bomb went off, right? He recreates this conversation. And the mechanic says to him, he goes, well, this is where the explosion was, but it wasn't a bomb. And Richard Clark says, no, what was it then? It wasn't a bomb. He goes, no, you know, we had these tired old 747s with these leaky gas tanks, and some spark of faulty fuel pump or something. Sets a spark off, and the whole fuel tank just blew up spontaneously, right? And he recreates this whole conversation. Then Clark says he goes back to Washington. He meets with his with Tony Lake, who's the National Security Advisor, and Leon Panetta, who's the Chief of Staff, and then he draws them a diagram of the 747, and he explains his theory. And then he says we're all positively encouraged, because it was just about that time, and this is where we left off the larger narrative, that the authorities were going to move from, first the missile thing lasted for about 24 hours where they got that off the table. Then we live with a bomb for at least a month. Now they're about ready to move to a mechanical failure. And Richard Clark, the hero of the hour, the hero in his own book, the hero in his own mind, the legend in his own mind, is the one who discovers the reason for the mechanical failure. And no one questioned him on this. You guys have been around long enough to know how this stuff works.
But, sure.
It's just astonishing when you see it.
So he took it from the narrative, from the bomb scenario, which was from the missile to the mechanical failure. He was the origin of that, basically, on orders from, ostensibly from above, right?
Yeah, he takes credit for that. And why is he on Long Island in the first place? What's he doing in the hangar? When he's talking about it, here's what's really curious about it, too. He goes, I went up to Long Island, and I went to the hangar in Bethpage. Well, no, it's at Calverton. It's 45 miles further east. You know, get it right, you know? He never gets the height of he says, he talks about, he called this meeting on the night of July 17th, you know, by the way, for most domestic plane crashes, there's the NTSB takes over. There's no high-level security meetings in the White House. And this will say why there was in a second, address one of the questions one of your listeners called in. And then he says the plane was at 17,000 feet. The FAA said we have no reason to know why it blew out of the sky. Well, no, the plane was at 13,760 feet. The 17,000 was the later CIA concoction. And the FAA knew exactly why they called the meeting. And it had nothing to do with the eyewitnesses. It had to do, and this I'll address your listener's question here, it had to do with the radar data out of Tracon in New York, out of that, that they saw and the air traffic controllers saw. Because what they saw was a object speeding towards TWA Flight 800 on their radar screens and intersecting it at the moment TWA Flight 800 or TWA 800. In fact, that's where I got the title, just that the radar data reading, TWA 800, disappears from the screen. That's what set off these high-level meetings in Washington. That's why Richard Clark called in the anti-terror group. That's why the FAA, the CIA, the NTSB, etc., gathered in Washington that night. As one fellow there with the NTSB, Ron Schlied, says, and he's quoted in a book, like one of the rehashes, he says, you know, we looked at it, it looked like something was gaining speed and overtook TWA Flight 800. Well, that's what happened. That's what called the start of the meetings. And yet, as the reader says, what happens to that tape? Well,
Exactly. Where is that tape? So what you're saying is radar from Islip, New York, I suspect, right?
No, it's actually in Westbury.
Westbury?
That's okay. Where the Tracon Center is.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So, it's on Long Island, yeah.
All right. Well, regardless, the radar showed an object, an unidentified object. I would say the trajectory of that object from the surface to from the ocean or the ground to TWA Flight 800 in the past intersecting or stopping at the moment of crash. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I can add some detail here that's really interesting because in the last 2 weeks I've started running a series on American Thinker, and one of the people who contacted me as a result of it worked at the Westbury Center at Tracon, and he worked on the same screen as where this was seen. He came in just after it happened, and so he saw the tape, and it got into a little. These are kind of nice little controversies among people who know more than I do, because he said it was rising. He said that he could discern because he had had a military experience learning his radar. He said it was rising vertically. Okay. And then a lot of civilian controllers says, no, you can't see a vertical rise, but he insists you can. Regardless, they all agreed that this object, this intersected TWA, and TWA immediately disappeared from the screen. He came in and, you know, he saw it that night. The guy who saw it in real time briefed him because he had to answer the questions from the FBI. The next day, my air traffic controller comes back to the center. And he says to his boss, he goes, can we look at that tape again? He says, no. He says, why? He says, it's gone. And he says, you can't leave it here. He said, we have to keep this here because of FAA regulations as to determine, you know, whether this is an accident or what, you know. Mm-hmm. It was gone, never to be seen again. And he said to his supervisor, have you ever seen anything like this before? He said, never. You know, and every part of that investigation, when you talk to these people, they're talking about something unprecedented. In this case, it was immediately sent to Washington, and that's what set the wheels in motion in Washington. That's why Richard Clark calls this meeting. That's why everyone gets engaged. That's why the Clintons repair to the family quarters, and that's why the almost war of 1996 is set in motion. For history's. You know, to be ignored by historians, you know.
All right. What about when you mentioned radar? There was a reference in your book to surface vessels, boats in the
yes.
area. When 800 went down, boats and ships up and down that Long Island coast, many converged on a crash site. Okay. Now there were actually. Two debris fields, sort of.
Well, they just divide them up artificially. There's
right.
Basically three, but it's
okay.
Know.
All right. Which I want to ask you about too. I want to ask you about the how this plane broke up and how it does not fit with the center tank explosion kind of thing.
And that, I don't know if you saw this, but on the screen, Eric had the reconstructed plane of TWA-800, what it looked like after the investigators put it back together. And you can see how it had broken apart in the middle, just like...
And Jack had really gone into good detail about what happened in the hangars and such. When I read it, I was astounded as to the behavior, the actions, the activities of some of the people, the investigators. But I guess my question is, surface vessels here, any boats in the area that...
And this is curious, is that about a year or so after the crash, Louis Chilorio, the number two FBI guy in the scene, I probably mispronounced his name, but he's testifying. Mm-hmm. He said, yeah, we tracked down every single boat and ship, and we checked them all out, except for one.
Yeah.
This was the one that was fleeing the scene, right? And it was large enough to be picked up on the radar, and is fleeing the scene at like 30 to 35 knots, which is the speed of a cruiser, a Navy cruiser. And it was only 3 miles from the scene at the time it happened, and it went in the opposite direction, which is a nautical no-no. I mean, it's like
you'd
probably
right.
be tried for it. You know, it's a sufficient violation of the understanding of what a ship should do. It should be looking for survivors, but it fled. And that was the one ship, even though it was probably the largest ship in that area, that they were unable to identify.
Amazing. And yeah, you folks, again, the book TWA-800, The Crash, The Cover-Up, and Conspiracy. Check it out on casual.com or amazon.com. Certainly, let's make it go to the top. The facts in here, the investigative results in here, I mean, it's a beautiful read. I'll just say that. I don't want to get ahead. I mean, because this is an investigation, I don't want to ask you leading questions necessarily, and I don't want to get ahead of myself. So I'm going to kind of just let you walk us through where you want to provide the information on this book, only because the way you've written it, I've read so many investigative reports over 30 years, and none of them, boy, you talk about some dry reading, but your way of writing and getting the information across to the reader is just amazing here. But I don't want to put the cart before the horse, so to speak, here. So go ahead and just continue to walk us through.
Sure.
Hold our hands here if you don't mind.
Right. By the way, and you're right. What I tried to, I write it, it's a first person account of my own journey from skeptic to, from skeptic of the skeptics to understanding it. Yes. The government was capable of pulling off this incredible cover-up. And for me, it's like Alice in Wonderland. It's like a journey into things that you had never thought you could ever experience. And I also, I'm not an aviator. I'm not an engineer. And most of these kind of books are written by people who are, and they lose the reader because they're talking about parts. But this is really a story about people. And about politics. And so I try to tell the story of the people who really got into this, like my partner James Sanders, his wife Elizabeth, the Tom Stalkup and Christina Borgeson, who makes the documentary, Ray Lair, this investigator, the family members who were affected by this, who've been all pursuing the truth all along. And it's really a really pretty stirring saga of people who will not yield, who will not give up, the eyewitnesses who refuse to be subdued.
Mm-hmm.
Then side stories like that of Kurt Weldon, the congressman.
Oh, yeah, yeah, from our state here.
Right, who tried desperately to break this open, and what happened to him.
Finally, raid. Yeah,
yeah.
Hate that when that happens.
So it's a human interest story. It's not a story of airplane parts. It's a story of people and their passions and their pursuits. Well, let's get back to the main narrative.
Sure.
And that is, okay, for a month or more, the New York Times, by the way, the FBI spoke exclusively New York Times, or almost exclusively. So, and the New York Times became extremely dependent on that source, and they prided themselves on it. And they became corrupted by it. If they weren't pre-corrupted going in, which is always an issue.
Yeah, they were. They were one of many newspapers to be owned by... the Federal Reserve elitist, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, that's why David Rockefeller in his memoirs said, you know, thank you to the New York Times and the Washington Post and other publications who helped hide our work for over 40 years. Without that help,
right,
we would not be able to get to the level we were, where we are at today.
Don't tell.
And yeah, the, you know, it's odd because I talked at some point to the guy who covered it for the Washington Post, and he was upset because he, like everyone else, was shut out of the information flow. So the FBI is communicated through the New York Times, and the New York Times became essentially a, you know, an echo chamber, and they just sort of reinforced what the FBI told them. And in the beginning, they had no reason to doubt the FBI, and like for about 2 weeks. And then after that, the story began to change. And the problem became, as I sort of mentioned in the last hour, is that the FBI oversold, or sold very well, the bomb story. So for weeks, there are new revelations about explosive residue found on the plane, PETN and RDX, and found on the wing, it's found in the interior cabin, it's found here, it was found there.
It's found inside the actual plane from rows 17 through 19, yep, rows 15 through 25.
Yeah,
right.
And somebody went to jail for this, right? James Sanders.
James Sanders did for trying to test it, yeah.
Right, right. So from the hangar, okay, can you... Because I've gotten questions about this, and I've read James Sanders' story, and yeah, I know how it starts, and I know how it ends, but I know a lot of people out there may not be familiar with it. So you want to just kind of give us a once over on the James Sanders, you know, what happened and what the results were from the independent testing of the material?
Yeah, what happened is that James Sanders, and James and I are very tight. In fact, I have a text message him from here right now. He doesn't give up. And he reminds me a lot of Kallstrom. They're about the same age, Jim Kallstrom, the head of the FBI. They're both medium height, bulldoggy kind of,
yep,
tenacious, you know. Oh, James Sanders has a good sense of humor. He needs it to have persisted as far as he's gone. But his wife, Elizabeth, was a trainer. And so 53 TWA employees were killed in this crash. And TWA is like a family. It's like having a... You know, the guy I talked to today, the pilot, he went to 14 funerals. You know what I mean? And so did Elizabeth. And at one of those memorial services, she ran into this pilot and a manager who was working the investigation named Terry Stacy.
Mm-hmm.
And she always thought of him as a real straight arrow, go by the rules kind of guy. And so when he came to her and said, he goes, is your husband still an investigative reporter? And she said, yeah. He goes, you know, I'd kind of like to talk to him. And what Elizabeth did is she introduced Terry Stacy to her husband James, and for that, she was indicted and tried as for conspiracy and convicted in federal court. That was it.
But Terry had removed, right?
A little pinch. And now Terry was, like many of the people involved, was very distressed by what the FBI was doing to this investigation.
Mm-hmm.
They were not letting them see the information. They'd ask about the results of tests, and they weren't told.
Stacy brought residue to the attention of the FBI, and weeks later they refused to share their laboratory findings on the residue.
That's
Terry sent a little piece of foam, right, to Joe.
Well, this was after, you know, Joe's right, is once he was frustrated, he couldn't, because the FBI wouldn't tell him, and they all thought that this was very indicative of something. And so that's when he and Sanders were talking, and they said, why don't you scrape off some of that residue, you know, on the backs of the seats, this orange streak across a whole section of rows, and I'll have it tested in an independent lab, and we'll see what we come up with. Well, Stacy goes in, and it won't scrape. And that little detail, it ends up affecting a lot of lives. So he takes a pinch of foam rubber, and he FedExes it. He doesn't use the U.S. mails. To Sanders. Sanders has it tested, and it proves a positive match for, explosive residue. Sanders goes public with this. Here's a picture of James on your TV.
Yep.
A California newspaper prints up his results, and then the FBI then knew they had a real problem on their hand. Is not only had this pinch of foam rubber left, they didn't know what else had, right? So they got really panicky. And they went after the Sanders because they were vulnerable. Elizabeth had to go into hiding, in a trailer park in Oregon, because she didn't want to give up Stacy, you know. And she was afraid that she wouldn't be able not to resist. You know, she loses her job, and she loved TWA, and that hurt her probably more than even getting arrested. Then they finally, through their own channels, they found their way to Stacy. They threatened his family. They threatened his pension. And then he finally pled guilty. And then they took the Sanders to trial and in a federal court. The Sanders were not allowed, Jim was not allowed to tell the court that he was a reporter. He'd written two books already. They couldn't talk about that, and they tried him as a common criminal for stealing airplane parts, right? The residue wasn't a part of the airplane, but the pinch of foam rubber was. And there was an ocean of foam rubber. I mean, it could have, you know, they had, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
And then that's what the story that triggered me that got me involved. When I saw that, I said, boy, these people are serious. They're playing hardball here, you know? And that's what got everyone in trouble. Now, getting back to what I was talking about earlier, though, why did they have to have this tested outside the FBI? Is because after the FBI sold the bomb story, and there's explosive residue all over the plane, above the fold headlines, explosion device in cabin blows it up, how could they untell that story? Right?
Yeah.
And they had to because the White House decided that they couldn't live with a bomb or a missile. They wanted mechanical failure, just like Richard Clark had discovered. So how do you untell that story, right? So the same day that the New York Times headline ran, Prime Evidence Found, this is 3 days before the Democratic Convention, the FAA began a coerced worldwide search for proof that a dog training, explosive training exercise had taken place on board the Flight 800 plane. Now, they'd never systematized these records. They're all done randomly by the local police. So this, you can imagine the man hours that went into pouring through these records until they find out this is, I would say, conceivably the most single corrupt moment in the whole investigation on everyone's part. They find that there was a test done in St. Louis 6 weeks before the crash on board a 747 on the same day the TWA 800 plane was there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and when you look at the development in the news stories cycle, first, we have a story breaking out of Washington from Jim Hall and the NTSB, a political hack,
right.
Says, now we're beginning to think that maybe it was a mechanical malfunction after all. And so the people who have been reading and say, how could it be mechanical? There's explosive residue found all over the plane. Well, the next day, right, they break the story that there had been a dog training exercise aboard the TWA Flight 800 plane in St. Louis, and the careless police officer spilled explosive residue all over the plane. Now, I checked the chronology here. By that date, no one in the FBI had talked to the officer. They released that before they talked to the officer. No one in the New York Times had talked to the officer. They released that story, right? Now, the investigators on Long Island, the serious ones, they said it was like a shot, punch in the stomach. All those explosive residue traces now, we can't take this to court. We can't take this the next step because it's a sloppy, careless police officer. Well, here's the horrible part of all this, is that just with the slightest bit of investigation, the New York Times would have discovered three things. One, is that the officer only reported the time of his exercise. This is according to the FBI documents. I use their own documents here to hang them. They only reported the time of the exercise and 747, right?
Mm.
That's all that he reported on his report.
Pretty vague.
Right. He also reported where he placed the explosives, and he also reported what kind of explosive training aids he placed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, from his timetable, the earliest he could have finished that plane was 12:15 p.m., just afternoon, because he started like at 10:45. It takes 90 minutes. You got to place the things, got to get the dog, let the dog search for them, find them, take the dog back. Well, at 12:15 p.m., The Flight 800 plane had 450 people on board and was about ready to leave for Hawaii 15 minutes later, right? Uh-huh. Now, sitting next to it was a clone 747, totally empty, that would not take off for another several hours. Right. The officer did his exercise on an empty plane, and you have to, totally sterile sure. environment. Now, to load a 747 for a flight, yeah, they start at least 90 minutes ahead of time, stocking and loading, and yep. the flight attendants, the crew has to be there an hour ahead of time. The officer didn't see a single soul during his whole thing. Then, if you check where he places explosives, that did not correlate at all with where the explosive residue was found. And finally, there was the composition of the explosive training aids in no way matched the RDX or PETN that was found on the plane. So it was a triple whammy. The least bit of scrutiny, the New York Times could have busted that story the same day it came out. But they never talked to the cop. Let's see, 6 years after this incident, after the cop has been thoroughly humiliated, yep. And scolded by the FAA and made to be a laughingstock by the FBI, him and his dog Carlo, my father was a cop. He was a police detective in Newark, New Jersey. So was my uncle, and mm-hmm. several of my cousins were cops. So I feel very comfortable in that world. One of my cop friends from New Jersey, I asked him, could you intervene with this guy and see if he'll talk to me? You know, he's a black guy. His name's Herman Burnett. I talked to him in 2002. He said, you're the first person in the media to contact me.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. He said, I didn't spill anything. I didn't lose anything. He goes, I hate the way they twisted my words. They humiliated me, you know? And he is still, he said, I am, can I say this on the air? To this day, you know?
It's almost like, when I read the account, it was, I was thinking, my goodness, did this police officer just kind of, you know, have leaky bags and stuff flying everywhere? And I mean, come on. But no, I mean, he's certainly vindicated by the facts.
And then, that's, you know, about a year later, maybe 6 months later, Jim Kallstrom, the head of the FBI investigation, is called before a congressional investigating committee.
Yeah.
And there's a big story here, too. And they ask him, by this time, certain investigators had been doing their work, especially Accuracy in Media and Reed Irvine, and they knew that the whole dog story thing was a crock, and they had the evidence to prove it. They right. had the pilot activity sheet, they had the timetables, all that, the FBI's own timetables. And so Jim Trafficant, the congressman who, by the way, just gets sent to prison after he does this, says to Kallstrom, he goes, Now, we have reason to believe. Are you sure that that the exercise was done at the TDR plant? Oh, absolutely, positive, sure. And then he goes, and it was some cop with leaking chemicals dripping all over the place, and it just happened to drip exactly in the place where we found the explosive residue. And he's just, there's no nice way to say what Kallstrom had done there. It was a multi-tiered lie, you know, and he lied about the placement of it, the composition, and the airplane itself.
Right.
And, you know, they knew he was lying, and they had a hard time proving it at that point. And Trafficant, who was from not too far from here, and paid for his transgression because he was then investigated and sent to prison. He may have deserved it, but then you could probably say that for half the people in Congress.
No, that's true. Yeah, I've got some contacts know the backstory with Trafficant. So, anyway, yeah, it's... very interesting how he had how that all came down.
But once that story broke, the media bought it totally.
Yeah,
and the whole explosive residue thing went away. And now it's just from the next 4 years, 3 years until the NTSB closes its case, mechanical failure. Then the search for some bizarre explanation as to why a perfectly functional 747 blows up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, okay, we're. Kallstrom keeps coming up in this. What's up with Kallstrom? I mean,
you know, if you've seen him lately on Fox News, where he's their like terrorist expert,
yeah,
he's been great, and it's shocking. I mean, he was up there the other night, and Megyn Kelly had to cut him off. I don't know if you saw this, but he says, there's a wet blanket of political correctness that's totally devastating our ability to seek, you know, Islamic terrorists.
And, right.
And then he said, like, and then he goes on to say, on the air, he said, Hillary Clinton's number one aide, Huma Abedin. Her family's a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, you know? Mm. And then you see Megyn Kelly getting nervous, and then she cuts him off, you know? And he's been doing this. I think he's trying to atone. I think he's a fundamentally decent human being who got roped into this, and then probably for reasons, I'm sure they would explain the reasons of national security. I'm sure they didn't tell, hey, we got to get reelected, you know?
Right.
Because he's working against, obviously working against Hillary Clinton's best interest right now. But yet for the next couple of years, he just lied after lie after lie. And I think he's trying to atone.
Interesting.
Because on September 11, 2001, he's on the air with Dan Rather, CBS. And then Dan Rather says, what's going on here? And then he blurts out, the hypocrisy has got to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And then Rather says, what are you talking about? And then he backs off and says, well, not that hypocrisy got us to this place. But yes, hypocrisy did get you to that place. And he knew it. So he quits his sinecure at MBNA, you know, where all the FBI people go to collect big paychecks until they die, including Louis Free, and takes a job as the top advisor to George Pataki in New York State.
Nice.
Interesting.
Okay.
If we can, I want to move on and let me know if we're jumping too far ahead.
No,
the black boxes.
Yeah.
Denial of public access to results of testing and analysis of abnormal sound data contained near the end of the cockpit voice recorder record. Now, the Flight 800 cockpit voice recorder, or the CVR, recorded a loud sound just before it stopped functioning, which NTSB investigators attributed to the sound of the explosion that caused the crash, because four different cockpit microphones recorded the explosion. A unique sound signature could be investigated. But apparently, the NTSB, the Sound Spectrum Group, was formed to study and studied publications from the previous aircraft explosions to determine what type of event, or if this was a depressurized event, what caused the crash. Well, what happened to the cockpit voice recorder
and the flight data recorder?
That is an excellent question. And it's another one of those coincidences here. Okay, the plane goes down in 120 feet of water about 8 miles off the coast of Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
Right off the Coast Guard station, right? They... the rescue people, the first priority is to get bodies, you know, and that's understandable. But the ships that are out there that night hear the pingers, you know, these little underwater beacons that tell you where the boxes are. The boxes are actually, they're bright orange. I don't know why they call them black boxes, but, and they're indestructible. You know, they're designed to take any kind of abuse possible. And yet, the next day, the NTSB goes out and they can't find them, right? They can't find them. And then 6 days go by, the Navy says, oh, it's too rough, we can't go in. They're using other devices other than, you know, the things to find them. Now, the black boxes will tell you almost always the story of what happens. If there's a mechanical failure, for instance, some months before, there's a plane, I believe it was a Turkish plane, that crashed off the coast of the Dominican Republic in 7,200 feet of water. You know, it's 60 times deeper than this. Navy came right in, found the black boxes, and our Navy, you know, helped out, found the black boxes, and they tell the story. And the cockpit voice recorder, you have 3 minutes of anguish, which usually happens when there's a mechanical failure. Oh, my God, what's this? Until the end, where all pilots say the same thing. Oh!
Yeah.
S-H. You know, yep. Blah, 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 you know? I mean, it's oddly, you listen to these tapes, it's not funny, but they almost all say the same thing. And then flight data recorder will then tell you, explain through its, you know, the instrumentation, what went wrong.
Right.
And they were able to tell that with the Virgin Air flight.
The functioning of the engine, what was running.
Right, what was working, not working.
Yeah.
Well, with Flight 800, it appeared to independent analysts that the final seconds of each were missing. Nothing comes out of the cockpit voice recorder. and the FDR, except for that one boom sound, and FDR, nothing. They tell them nothing. So they find them a week later, right? They say, oh, it's too rough. They must be damaged. They must be buried, blah, blah, blah. They're giving all these excuses. And then they show the video of the Navy divers who finally go in, and they find the boxes. It's like stumbling off across the hassock in your living room. They're just sitting there. And like, yeah, you pick them up, like, oh, you can see the video. Yep. Oh, I got the box. They're orange, by the way, and they can't miss them. And then there's, you know, it's just like, now the Navy divers at this point are innocent. They're probably happy they found them. Wow, this is great. We went a week, we couldn't find them, and now they're right here. But they were just I'm sure they were taken immediately that first night and replaced a week later with the final seconds of each edited out. They told the investigators nothing useful about the plane crash. Neither one of them, which is unprecedented also.
And you know, when I read that, I had to stop and think. I mean, how orders like that, I mean, to destroy evidence, essentially, and then replant the evidence for the Navy to find. And by the way, during the claims when, oh, it's too rough, according to the weather records and the on-site records, it wasn't rough at all.
No, and the private divers were putting teams right in all the time, you know, just right to, you know,
but,
for...
But, I mean, but to think about this, you would have to, for something like that to happen, because we're talking about a crime scene here, obviously the orders would have to come from the very top, right?
And they'd have to come immediately.
Immediately.
Yeah. Like that night or the very next morning. And this was, and, you know, and I don't go into too much detail about this in the book because I don't exactly know. I have some evidence, some ideas of what happened, where they went, and so on and forth. There's some information about that. None of it's conclusive. But the evidence of the private analysts who looked at it said, no, the final seconds are missing. Even the NTSB board member, the one guy, Golia, admits that, yeah, they're just missing. We don't know what happened to them. Well, a lot of things went missing. Airplane parts, you know.
Yeah.
Residue, glue, you know, radar data, extra eyewitness testimony, you know, it all goes missing.
And it's amazing, the evidence tampering that you get into. Folks, Jack Cashel is our guest. His book, TWA 800, The Crash, The Cover-Up, and The Conspiracy. It's a fantastic book. It's coming out on July 5th. Pre-ordered today. Let's make this... 20 years ago, next month, let's make this the main issue here. I would love to see Hillary Clinton have to answer for the Clintons' involvement as to what happened on the night of July 17th, 1996, and subsequent to that.
Right. And, you know, and Doug, when I talk to people in the major media about this, and they didn't want to blow it off, or it's 20 years old. I said, we're talking about a story here that's bigger than Watergate.
Yep.
And its implications. And in fact, it's so big and so pervasive that I would recommend that there be like the South Africa-style Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Because who arrests who at this stage of the game, you know?
Good point.
But it seems to me that anyone who was involved in the orchestration of this should be immediately removed from office or any consideration of running for office. And, you know, the orchestrators, I think, maybe we don't give them that same truth and reconciliation part, you know.
But yeah, those people, however, just following orders. And under the presumption or under the color of national security, I can see that.
Sure.
Throw in compartmentalization, just having that, as you said, that quarter mile strip of that.
Right.
You know, knowing what you only know and not knowing what you don't know. And acting under the presumption of national security, I can see where, and perhaps somebody's listening to this. Maybe you were involved in some way on that night. If you were, this is the guy to get a hold of.
jcashel@aol.com.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the last 2 weeks, I've gotten 10 great leads from people. I spent an hour on the phone today with a pilot who worked the investigation and got thrown off. I spent an hour yesterday with an FBI agent. When I'm starting to turn FBI agents, that's a good sign, you know?
Man, that's
because they risk a lot to talk. And in the book, as you see, a lot of these guys were willing to put their names on their accounts, you know?
Yeah, and that's the other thing, too. I think the first couple of pages you attributed a pseudonym to an eyewitness, but yes. Beyond that...
And I have her name. I mean, I know who she is. And,
right.
But she hasn't come forward publicly herself, so I chose just to use her number.
Well, and the other...
That might be a story worth telling right now. Just
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Because I start the book with it.
Yeah.
And it was in 2009... And I'm in my Kansas City office, and I get a call from this woman, and she says, Jack Cashel? I said, yeah. She goes, I'm witness number 73. Do you know who I am? I said, upside down Nike swoosh? She goes, that's me. You got it. Here's which, and then I read, you know, and I go into her FBI reports, and she's on the beach that night, about 8 or 10 miles from the witness. She's an aviation, she's a travel industry professional. With an interest in aviation, and she's watching Flight 800 across the sky, and it catches her attention because it's lower than she thought it should be at that stage. That's how much she knows and how closely she follows these things. It's leveled off, and she's right, it did, because it actually leveled off to allow another plane to pass overhead. She's watching it, and then she sees come up off the horizon, as she describes it, an object like a flare, burning red tip, white smoky contrail. She watches it. She watches it ascend. And then she said it corrects its motion at the last second like an upside-down Nike swoosh. She said it hits the right wing of the airplane, or near the right wing of the airplane. She says then she watches as the front end of the plane breaks off and falls into the sea, right? And then she watches the rest of the plane continue on just for a little bit, then turns into a burning fireball and plunge into the sea. She not only saw... the missile ascend, hit the plane exactly in the right place on the right wing, but then she describes the breakup sequence of the airplane weeks before the authorities were able to confirm it. That front end of the plane, the cockpit and the first class section, broke off and fell into the sea first. And then the rest of the plane soldiered on for, you know, half mile or whatever, and then fell into the sea behind it. Nothing ascended, and so she called me, and I was curious as to why she was calling me, and we reviewed her record. And she said, you know, I've just found out what happened to my witness. I didn't know that, you know, she didn't know she wasn't alone, you know?
That's an amazing, yeah.
And so she said, there's certain things. I said, then tell me why, when the FBI came back to re-interview in April 1997, why did you change your story? Because when the FBI comes back the second time, she says, I don't remember exactly what I saw. I don't know which wing, blah, blah, blah. I know I didn't exactly see it come up off the horizon, you know. And she goes, well, I have to tell you about that second interview. I said, and what's that? She goes, you know, it says where I was drinking Long Island iced teas beforehand. She goes, I don't know what a Long Island iced tea is. It's a cocktail. It says Long Island iced tea cocktail.
Right.
And I said, might it have been another drink? She goes, no, because I don't drink. You know, they added in the second interview, the drink to make her look drunk. And then I said, then she said, there's something else you may not know about my second interview. I said, what's that? She goes, there was no second interview.
Yeah, did you see that coming?
They made it up. And then I said, there's something you may not know. And she said, what's that? I said, you're not the only one. And at least three key eyewitnesses, the CIA and or FBI, manufactured brand new interviews to negate the effect of the initial interviews. And this included the three most critical of all eyewitnesses. There's probably a lot more they did this to that I don't know about, because I've been in touch with these three. But, and they swear, no second interview.
Right.
Not only her, but the man on the bridge around whom the CIA developed its final fatal...
Mike Wire, I think.
Yep. Who's become a real good friend of mine. And also Dwight Brumley, a Navy guy who was on a U.S. air flight flying overhead Flight 800 when he saw it, and who really, you know, had radar training and missile test training and was shocked that they didn't come talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
But in each case, the CIA manufactured new eyewitness things, and in the case of Flight Witness Number 73, they actually put one in her file. In the case of Wire... they just improvised it on the spot, but they didn't put it in his file. And then in the case of Brumley, they just switched it out. but they unmistakably left the old one in the file. So we have two, one in which he's saying it goes right to left, and they have him saying it goes left to right. That's how utterly corrupt this investigation was with the CIA's involvement.
It's easy to believe, I suspect, but it's more than incompetence, obviously.
And I should add, with Witness 73 and reading her files and talking to her, she wasn't grandstanding. She was on the beach with two of her in-laws, and they would not talk to the FBI. And they saw what she saw, which means that there's many, many more people on Long Island who saw it than talked to the FBI. And they were upset that she gave them their names. In fact, her fiancé, who was, they were about to get married, was so upset, it almost caused a break up the relationship, because they didn't want to have anything to do with the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
And then she figured out why that was so.
She contacted, what changed? It was because of her husband now?
What happened is that her husband was dead set against her participating.
Right.
When I talked to her, her husband was, for whatever reason, in St. Joseph, Missouri, about an hour from where I was, and he had, if I remember her correctly, stage 4 cancer and was in terminal stages. Otherwise, she would never have even talked to me. And what I did is I said to her, I got her name and number and everything, and I said to her, I called her maybe a few days later, I said, I'm going to be in St. Joe next week. Why don't we have lunch? I wasn't going to be. I just say I'm passing through. And she goes, no, I'm sorry. This is as far as I go with this. I can't talk about this anymore.
Amazing.
And that's true of a lot of people, and I don't blame them,
Well, yeah, why put yourself in the middle of this firing line, especially knowing the corruption? And I use that word intentionally, corruption. I think it's fair to say that we've got not only a cover-up and a conspiracy, but, this is some pretty serious. What you've discovered, uncovered, and reported, extremely serious, and I can't think of a reason for national security. I don't know.
I'm sure that they, I suspect, I should say, I'm not sure, but the people at the next level of cooperation,
yeah,
maybe even including Jim Kallstrom, were probably told a false story. I think they were told the Iran story. That we think that it was Iran, we're not sure, we don't want to retaliate unless we're sure, for reasons of national security and to save the airline industry, we've got to, suppress this story. But the top echelon of people, the Gorelicks, the Sandy Bergers, the Clintons, and maybe not much deeper than that, knew. They knew what they were doing. I think Dick Morris knows too.
And you can control, really, you can control the entire investigation with that limited number of people.
Yeah.
Because of the centralization of information and power.
And a few people in the Navy knew what happened too.
Okay.
Not many, but a few.
And with the media complicity.
Yeah.
That's the icing on the cake.
You're absolutely right, Joe. Without a guarantee of that, they could never, no Republican president could ever, ever have tried to do this.
Do we know or have an idea, and I know we're reaching the top of the hour, we'll be taking a break here and then coming back with our third and final hour with author Jack Cashel, author of TWA Flight 800. Do we have motive? Do we have suspects? Do we have reasons?
Yeah, and in fact, maybe we should save that for the third hour. And
I knew you were going to ask that.
That's a good, excellent question.
Yeah.
Who shot him?
Yeah.
We haven't even broached that question yet. And I will say this, when I got into it, and once I was convinced that it was a missile, I wanted it to be terrorists. Just my gut wanted it to be terrorists.
Right.
Because the alternative is, I didn't want to contemplate.
As opposed to what, Bill Clinton with an RPG? And,
Colonel Plum the study with the candlestick. No, the alternative is U.S. Navy misfire.
Bad. Just think about that.
And you alluded to something at the very beginning of the show about something that was going on. I'm not sure if it was some kind of drill.
Missile test.
Was that what it was?
Yeah, and a missile test, but a high state of alert. And it's not impossible that it was some combination of the two, a terrorist action and a naval misfire. But I will say this, I don't want to drag out the suspense. The U.S. Navy was involved in this.
Folks, we're going to hear more about this on the other side. We're talking with in-studio guest Jack Cashel. His book, TWA 800, pre-order it now. It comes out on the 5th of July. You can go to Amazon and order that. Again, TWA 800. We'll be right back with our third and final hour with Jack Cashel right after these short messages.
Stay with us. Too, right?
Yeah. Stay with us. And the Hagman & Hagman Report.
This is the Global Star Radio Network.